everybody. How are you doing? Good. Let's move on, shall we? Great. So I'm really excited about this, to bring on my next guest, who I discovered through Chelsea Green Publishing. I really love that house, and I've talked to a number of authors from that publishing company. Will Bonsall has worn many hats since going back to the land, including prospector, draftsman, gravedigger, hobo, musician, logger, and artist, among others. However, he considers subsistence farming to be the only true career he ever had. He is director of the Scatter Seed Project, which he founded to help preserve our endangered crop plant diversity. His first book, Through the Eyes of a Stranger, is an eco novel set in a sustainable society of the future. He is also the author of The Essential Guide to Radical Self-Reliant Gardening, Innovative Techniques for Growing Vegetables, Grains, and Perennial Food Crops with Minimal Fossil Fuel and Animal Inputs. Will lives and farms in Industry, Maine, with his wife, Molly Thorkesten, and two sons. Will, how are you doing today?
I'm doing fine, Karen. How are you?
Good. I really, really enjoyed spending time with your book.
I think you did very well to read it all in the time since I last talked to you. As you noticed, it's a pretty extensive, it's a pretty long thing. You could have done War and Peace in half the time, perhaps, eh?
It is dense. It is intense. I took a lot of notes, and I like to think that one day, I live in New York City in an apartment building with a terrace, but you know, there is a part of me that longs to grow food. And if that ever does happen, your book is going to be right there with me, guiding the way.
Well, I hope you find something useful in it.
Thank you. There's so many interesting things to talk about, especially from a book of 400 pages. But let's just start with simple concepts that you talk about, like eco-efficiency, which you mentioned you thought you had come up with, but then found others use the same term with similar definitions. And I want to connect that with permaculture and organic gardening, because I know my listeners are interested in that. Can you riff on that?
Yeah, you bet. Those are two very interesting comparisons and contrasts you're making, because they both are similar but different. And I would, knowing what I think of the mix of your radio audience, I would point out in the very beginning that one of the things that's distinct about my, quote, my veganism is it is not primarily predicated on what I call bunny hugging or compassion or ethical, you know, things like that. Although I have, that's totally, those are all totally good reasons. I don't know of any bad reason to be a vegan. But I tend to avoid ideology per se in my writing, particularly in that book, because I'm trying to appeal to people who are, I like to not just preach to the choir. And one of the arguments, in fact, my main argument initially for going vegan and veganic in my farming system, not just what I eat, but what I, how I grow what I eat, thing that you refer to is eco-efficiency, the fact that it is simply unecological, unbusinesslike. I always like to refer to that, because an awful lot of people are, we tend to be, I think, sometimes some of us rather cynical, and we're not too moved by someone saying this is some unethical thing. But we like to think that we're all sensible, reasonable, irrational people. And when someone points out that this is irrational, why, that appeals to something a little more visceral, I think. And that's what I'm trying to do. So you make the analogy or comparing it with organic. One of the points, as you found in my book, that I emphasize is I initially started off my working career in the mining business, prospecting and so on. And I didn't like it. It's a rather dirty business, and I got out of it. I wanted to get into something more recycling. And what could be more recycling than organic farming? But hardly get into it, I started hearing and reading about, well, if you use so many tons per acre of phosphate and lime and all these things, and all these things that are mined somewhere, and I had to ask myself, I thought I got out of that business. Why is that so crucial to organic farming? And so my book, among other things, deals with some of those issues of how to avoid be a farmer without being a miner. And you also referenced the permaculture thing. And again, even though I see a true permaculture system is really the ideal of sustainable agriculture, sustainable food system, the way usual method I hear, the usual techniques I hear applied to permaculture basically involve growing a lot of things to feed to an animal and then eat the animal. And to me, that basically kind of nullifies the main advantage of permaculture, of not tilling and not having to have bare ground and all that kind of stuff. But then when you put that stuff through an animal, then you lose so much of the efficiency of it, like 90% you're throwing away. So I just don't get it. I think there is something that's more organic than organic, and I think there's something that's more permaculture than permaculture. And those are the things I'm trying to aim at and discussing a lot in my book.
I have a thing with the word efficiency, and often I don't like when it's used, because a lot of industry, for example, will use efficiency to obtain certain goals, and they'll support efficiency in their terms, and efficiency is not always the best thing, especially when people's livelihoods are at stake.
I think efficiency, really efficiency, always is the best thing. It's just that we often call things efficient that are not really the things that you're referring to.
Exactly.
You have to look at the bottom line, and again, that's one of the things in my book. I try to make sure we're looking at the real bottom line. When we say that this makes sense or doesn't make sense, it's often because we're not allowing for the externalities in it, and that's the very thing you're referring to. So for that same reason, I sound very crassly pragmatic and am about, yes, we want efficiency, real efficiency, bottom line efficiency, not just something that has the appearance of being efficient.
Yeah, well, the appearance of being efficient means the highest profits at any cost.
Exactly. And that may not be real profit. That may be like short-term profits or not unsustainable profits. And again, that's not good business. That's not real efficiency. We disguise an awful lot of things in our lives, in our civilization, under this mantle of, and the marketplace allows us to do a lot of that. And the other thing that allows us to do it is this ocean of petroleum underneath us. That a lot of things that appear to be efficient that are not efficient at all, that really would, in a quote, real world, after peak petroleum especially, just won't work anymore. This thing that we call civilization that we've been doing for, a couple few thousand years, looking at the big picture, we really have to ask questions like, is this civilization really a sustainable thing, or is it just flash in the pan? Is it here today, gone? Well, what's a thousand years? What's a couple thousand years? It's nothing. How long can we keep doing this without undermining our base?
That is the question, isn't it? one of the big concepts that I really enjoyed early on, and I don't think I've ever thought of it this way, but this rather than well, the real sustainability is this cycle that you talk about, where we grow crops, we eat them,
exactly.
So we're taking, and then we put all of that right back in the same place. We're not mining somewhere else and grabbing stuff from somewhere else. We're keeping everything right in that same place. Beautiful.
Round and round, round and round. If we do have to import something into the system, there are some things, certain trace minerals, for example, that simply are not there for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we do have to bring them from somewhere else. But should we have to every year, bring in so many, sometimes tons per acre of this or that? To me, it's mining, and it's not really sustainable, and it's not really organic.
That's right, but we're not there yet. Now, you talk about this imaginary futuristic society.
Oh, now you're in the other book now.
No, you did it in this book.
Well, that's right. I did reference it because it was sort of my take off my point of reference. What about a place called Hesperia? Yeah, thank you. That's right.
Yeah,
sure,
it's there. I mean, it makes me want to read the other one. But I love the idea of having an image of what life could be like, because I feel that when we imagine it, we can ultimately make it so.
You can't build anything without a blueprint first. You have to have, even if it's just simply in your head or lines on a paper, you can't start the real building business until you have to have the vision. And the main thing that novel proposes or offers is a vision, no ultimate the vision, but a one of any number of possibilities for a sustainable civilization. Actually, you haven't read that book, but what purports to, there's a great paradox in it, what purports to be the protagonist of the story, the fellow Yarrow, and what happens to him and so on, is really just the backdrop. It's the context for the story. What appears to be the context of the story, the land of Hesperia, is in fact the protagonist. That's the real character, is this world.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, I want to read it. Is it 400 pages?
No, it's a little bit shorter. Actually, it's 365, I think, although it's the size of a novel size, not such big pages. And
okay,
there's a sequel to it, which I am just finishing almost as we speak. I'm just putting the finishing touches this last couple of weeks on a sequel to that. The two together are called the Yarrow Tales. I call it a bilogy as opposed to a trilogy. And the first one, the one that's referenced in the book, is called Through the Eyes of a Stranger. The sequel is called In the Larger House. And the reasons behind those titles are alluded to in the book when one figures out what they're called. But yeah, it's basically a possible vision of a sustainable, which incidentally is vegan. Yarrow's adopted nation of Hesperia, they're vegans, maybe partly because of compassion and that kind of stuff, but they basically need to maintain an advanced civilization on a finite footprint, a large enough population to be able to defend themselves and so forth, and yet without undermining their base.
Well, you'll have to let me know when that's out, and we'll have to talk about that on another program.
That would be a lot of fun.
Yeah. So you have so much knowledge, and you've built so many different things on your land. You cover everything from equipment to seeds to recipes to growing, nurturing the soil, so many different topics. Were you born into this?
So far from it. Now, I was raised about less than an hour from here, where I am, in Waterville, Maine, a mill town. My dad was a mail carrier, my mother was a telephone operator, and no, we had a small garden, but no, that was. I cannot say I was part of the back to the land movement, because like most of that movement, I was not going back to the land. I was going back to something I never came from.
Okay, so you just kind of figured this all out over the decades.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. It took me a lot longer than it would take most people, because being a guy, I don't ask questions. I don't do research. I just figure it out. I know all about how to do that, and then I do it two or three times, and eventually I figure it out. So, yeah.
Well, sometimes that's a great way to learn.
Well, I won't say it is. It's just the way I do things. It's not at all the way. I don't advocate it at all. But you commented now the wide range of the book, the gardening book. That's all the fault of my editor. When they approached me, they told me they had this idea for, they thought I'd like to do a book. They particularly were thinking I might do a thing on grain growing, since I'm known for small-scale grain growing. And sure, I could do that. And then what about this other thing you do, farming without manure? And yeah, I could do that. And went on and on. I threw out some ideas, and everything I said, yeah, they gave me carte blanche to write a book about everything I know and then some. And that's what you got.
All right, let's talk about veganics and gardening without manure and humanure.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Please.
What will we talk about it?
I want to know.
You start. You lead the direction, and I'll follow this one.
Okay, sounds good. Okay. Now, I've talked to a number of people who do veganic gardening, and I learned from some that it came out of necessity, not really any concern about animals. They were just in a location where they didn't have animals, so
very
they learned how to nourish the soil without animals.
I know quite a few people that do this exactly. In fact, some of them are meat eaters, but they just find out they live in the suburbs or something. They don't have access to animal manure, but they have grass clippings and they have leaves and things like that, the exact components of my system. Yeah, that's a very good point.
But there are many people who just can't fathom that. They believe that it's all part of the romance of nature, how we need to have animals on our property.
Oh, yes.
And there's one more thing here, because it always kills me. I think, okay, if you think you need to have the animals and you need to have their shit, why do you have to kill them?
Well, sooner or later you would. I'll be devil's advocate here. If you're going to keep animals, and because some people have thought they could, for example, initially when I first came here, I was not into eating meat, but I was going to have dairy goats. And, how do you have goats? You're going to have surplus nannies. You're going to have old goats, the dried up goats and so on. Somewhere along the line you have to deal with, or someone else has to. And that's again, my key focus is looking at the bottom line. Simply sloughing a problem off to someone else is not really solving the problem. So that's when I started realizing that, no, there's got to be a way of doing it without those things. And right along with it came the question of manure. What about the doo-doo? And that was when I first started realizing the doo-doo does not amount to much in terms of fertility. It's the mantra of organic gardening, you know, or cow pies is what makes the world go around. But in fact, animal manure, as the book explains in some detail, is ultimately not a source of fertility at all. The fertility ultimately comes from the plants, the hay, and the grain and stuff that the animal ate. And the manure is simply a byproduct of someone else killing and keeping and killing and eating animals. And in terms of building the soil, conventional organic gardening, by which I mean using livestock manure, doesn't actually build the soil at all. It barely tries to maintain the soil. But the only things, the way Mother Nature does it, is by the use of primarily forest, either grassland, prairie, grassland, or where there's enough water, forest. This is the ultimate eco-efficient system. This is a system which produces so much more bounty in one form or another, whether directly as food or as food for the food, produces so much more than it itself requires. And so if you really want a system that really, the bottom line is the big fat profit, then you really need to be looking at plants, not only on your table, but also to maintain the soil. And grass and particularly leaf forest residues, particularly leaves and chips and stuff, are really right where it's at.
I like where you told many stories and you have a great sense of humor, and you also talked about how your editor took out some of your humorous anecdotes. And maybe you want to share one that wasn't in the book here.
She was very indulgent. If she hadn't taken out some of them, it probably would have been banned in Boston. But they let most of it, some pretty cheeky remarks and stuff, quips I made there that they let pass. They say they're a wonderful publisher to deal with. They say we're trying not to muzzle our author's voice, and I can tell you that's true. They did. They didn't muzzle me really at all.
Well, I liked the concept of seeing value in someone else's garbage. And there are lots of ways to do this here in New York City. We have the freegans, we have the dumpster divers, people who grab things that are thrown away. Sometimes it's food, sometimes it's furniture, and they see value in someone else's garbage. And I've seen it too with compost or kitchen waste, throwing it away when it could become compost. And you talked about an elderly woman's leaves that you used to take from her.
The Austrian lady, yes.
Yeah. I mean, leaves, they're not garbage. I can't stand when I see people raking them and throwing them away because their ground right there needs them.
When I was a kid, we burned them. Everyone raked them in the ditch and burned them. Yeah, that's a very good example, because that woman herself, she did value them. She wouldn't let me have her leaves because she had a use for them, a very good, basically what I was doing with it, and which I used. That was one of a couple examples I used to overturn the conventional wisdom that leaves don't have much value, not much fertility in them. And her whole garden was based on leaves and nothing else. And so from that point of view, and mine too, the leaves almost are not a waste product. They're a primary harvest, and then the food that grows from them whichever way you want to go with it, is the ultimate harvest for me. So it's a very different situation when people in urban areas, you have essentially a salvage ecology, where there's a scavenging, like you say, taking whether it's the residues or old furniture, any of these kinds of things, which generally came from outside of the, let's say, the metropolitan limits or something, were brought in there, and they're keeping it circling round and round. So they're functioning somewhat like mushrooms, people in that situation. We're taking what's already there and keeping moving it around, which is very good for people in that situation. That's the only choice you really have, or it's the best choice you have. In my situation, I'm out where I have lots of those resources. I could be keeping animals and growing meat and milk and all that, but I just find a much more efficient, frankly, an easier way of doing the whole thing. And that's my compelling thing. I try to emphasize that because I'm not trying to appeal I'm not trying to preach to the choir. I'm not trying to appeal to people's higher motives. I'm trying to appeal to their crasser instincts. Geez, this is easy. I'm lazy. I don't want to do all that work. It works. You can laugh, Karen, but it works. I managed to reach a lot of people who were not vegan and maybe go ahead and leave me still not being vegan, but do something that's a whole lot better than what they were doing before. It's appealing to them wherever they're at, not where I am or where I think they should be.
So let me ask you, you obviously have time to write. How much free time do you have?
Very little. In the wintertime, the last few years have been particularly difficult because I was first doing that, the novel, and then this last book you're referring to, and then this winter trying to wrap up the sequel to the novel. And I also do articles regularly. They do take quite a lot of time. They're the main thing I do for money, actually. My own contribution to the household budget is mainly from writing and speaking, which, if you haven't noticed, I do a lot of that, and very fast and so forth. If I could get paid for words per minute, I'd be quite wealthy. But anyway, those are the things that I do as outreach, and I'm basically selling virtually nothing. There's very few of the things that I grow. They're primarily for my own consumption. And incidentally, that puts me in a kind of a unique situation because the person who the farmers, we have a lot of market gardeners around here and CSAs and stuff who produce food and send it off to the market. And as I emphasize in the book, that is one of two, and perhaps not even the second one, sources of erosion. One is stuff leaching, washing away, but the other one is the food sent off to the marketplace. Well, of course, we don't think of that. We don't think of that as erosion. That's what we're doing it for. And yet, when you think of the tons per acre of calcium, phosphorus, and nitrogen, all these things that get sent, and they ain't never coming back. I mean, long ago, before we had this marvelous invention called the flush toilet, there was a sort of a given symbiosis, kind of a compact between the country and the urban areas, because the urban areas weren't so big, but usually wherever you ate that stuff and pooed it out, someone collected it, recycled it, and went back to the fields, which were probably within a couple of miles of the center of the village or something. And we broke that cycle. We broke that contract with the earth when we got the flush toilet. That stuff goes away somewhere. The best that happens with it, it doesn't get back to the land that produced it.
There's a lot that's broken in this society, no question about that. And even when we evaluate the gross domestic product, we don't consider the value. You talk about this towards the end of the book, the value of the food that you're producing on your land. It has no value. I mean, it has tremendous value. And I want to grow food because, you know, there's a part of me that doesn't trust what's going on in the world. And I think there may be a time where it'll be difficult to get food. And for those who can grow it, you're the richest people around. But
well,
it's
kind of a happy irony for me is that I grow a very large percentage of my food, but certainly not all of it. A lot of people say that we grow all our own food here, and we don't. Other people that I've heard say they do, they don't either, if you look at everything. But I do grow a disproportionately large amount of my food, particularly the expensive parts of it, fruits and vegetables and so on, and some of the grain and legumes and stuff. And you know, every time when I'm right now in the middle of doing my tax form ready, and there's no line on my 1040 form for the value of the food that I grew and ate. I can't put it down. If I wanted to put it down, so I can't pay taxes on it because I'm both the producer and the consumer, the middleman and everything.
I want to jump around now. There's, you know, it's the Jewish holiday of Passover this
week. Right, exactly.
And I'm not a religious person. You mentioned you're an atheist. I am also someone who does not believe in a higher authority. And you were talking about alliums, and we all love when onions and garlic are frying. You were talking about that. And then I just want to read here, just as how we are addicted to the flavor of alliums, it's reflected in the story of the Exodus. The people of Israel are trekking around the Sinai, haven't recently escaped from a land where they endured slavery and genocide. Does anyone say, hey, guys, this manna stuff really hits the spot? No, they keep kvetching about how much they miss the onions and garlics and leeks they had back there. And then, of course, in the Ayurvedic, you continue tradition, India, garlic is something not to be eaten, onions and garlic, in the Jain society. I just found that humorous, and I thought it was appropriate to mention
I think I mentioned in there, supposedly the alliums are not conducive to spiritual development. And I said, that proves it. See, I eat them all the time, and I'm an atheist. Yeah, they nailed that one.
I love onions and garlic and leeks, especially when they're cooking.
You know, as you ever noticed, but I certainly notice, almost any time you come into a room or someone else comes into the house or something, and whenever you hear the comment, oh, something smells really good, it seems to be always one of two things. It's either onions or garlic frying, or it's something yeasty bread breaking, some sweet, you know, cake or dough or something like that. Those things seem to be highly evocative smells, flavors. It seems like even if we're cooking something that we really may love to eat, the smell of it doesn't seem to quite get our juices going, quite like those alliums.
Right. So I always love when I discover new things, and I wanted to talk about some of those things. You talk about using oil meal and using it instead of oil.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about what that is and
yeah.
how it works?
Well, I mean, basically there are the oil seeds, basically those crops that we grow to press oil from them, like cottonseed, canola, sunflower seeds, sesame, all those things that are grown like industrial scale agriculture and press oil. And we use the oil to fry things, to make mayonnaise and dressings and things like that. And fairly early in the game, we tried it. We were very serious about this, growing our own food. And we said, okay, what about the oil? That's, you know, all the people that think they're being so self-reliant because they're growing their mesclun mixes and their salsa ingredients, you know, and buying all their grain and, you know, all that kind of stuff. We want to really do this. So what about oil? And we tried growing a few things, canola, and we tried growing sunflower seeds, thinking to press oil from them. Well, at that time, we didn't have anything. We have since, but we did not have any technology to press the oil from them. We just went ahead and started on it, not knowing how we were going to continue it. And when we realized that it wasn't practical to do that, then it occurred to us, geez, this stuff has got the oil in it already, the sunflower seeds. Now, there's all this other stuff in the seed, too, all this protein and calcium and silicon and a lot of trace minerals in oil seeds, you know, fluorine and things like that. And so if we were to press the oil from this and eat the oil, which is the one part that our body can synthesize its own oil, and then take all that other stuff and feed it to a stupid mammal, a pig or a goat or something, and where is the sense in that? So what if we were to eat, since we're so much into whole foods, then instead of eating this extracted oil, what if we were to use the seed in its whole form? And so for years, we developed a whole cuisine of making, for example, something sort of like mayonnaise, using whole ground-up sunflower seeds, not pressing the oil, but the whole seed, and fermenting it to make a kind of a smetana, like a sour cream kind of a thing, and all kinds of things like that. If we wanted to fry pancakes, instead of putting a tablespoon of oil on the pan, well, get it with a cast iron pan, get it real hot first, and then sprinkle a little bit of ground-up sunflower meal on it, and real quickly, because it starts scorching wicked quick, put the batter on top of that. Well, then you end up with your pancake all crispy fried like it would have been in oil, but it has this coating of not just oil, but the toasted, not the seeds, the oil, it's this nuttier flavor, and of course, all the nutrition is there. You're not throwing away the most valuable part of it. So, yeah, we get into that very much. In more recent years, we've become backslid in some ways so that we do use more oil than we used to, but we still, from time to time, get our act together and revert back to using, as much as we can, using the seeds whole. Canola, we can grow canola here easily, but it is not. If you're going to use canola oil, you do have to extract it. So the canola seeds we had were not useful for an oil seed, but we had tons of it, so we played around with it. We discovered that, well, we could grow sprouts, sprouting these seeds, and they were very delicious, not as an oil seed, but as a winter, you know, winter vegetable sort of. So, yeah, we had a lot of go round and round with trying to grow our own oil, and we came up with a lot of very interesting things as a result of the effort.
Yes, I always like to say when you restrict something, you get really creative and your world expands.
Exactly. That and so many other things had that effect again and again with us. Likewise, trying to avoid animal manure. We found so many other things that were very serendipitous. We'd find something that was much more valuable than the thing we were trying to do in the first place. Sometimes failure can be delicious.
Okay, we have 3 minutes, and I have like 25,000 things I want to talk about, but I can't.
Okay, you got a second for each one then, how's that?
Okay, so I want to talk about humanure, and I want to talk about gardens without borders.
Okay, to start, first of all, with Gardens Without Borders, that was the original working title for the book, by the way. And what it ended up with, I love everything about the book except the title. But when it was all done, the publisher came up with this objection, a totally valid one. She said, Gardens Without Borders, well, it's catchy and all that, but the person will wonder, what does it mean? And I said, well, as soon as they open the cover in the very first paragraph, it's spelled out really clearly. She says, yes, but that's too late. When they're standing in the aisle at Barnes & Noble, it's got to get them right away before that. They'll never get to opening up. So they came up with this idea, Will Bonsall's Essential Guide to blah, 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 whatever. And I wasn't happy at all with it. I'm not at all happy with the title. But she was right. What had been the working title was not adequate. I think we should have come up with something still different. But the whole idea behind it is summed up in the very beginning. is, again, don't, when you're thinking about your garden, don't just think about that bit. When you look beyond the edges of your garden, I say, I assure you it's a mirage. There are no boundaries, borders to your garden. It just goes on and on and on in every sense. I mean, ecologically, economically, politically, whatever. I mean, everyone, the chairman of the board and the priest and the president, everyone is sitting right in the middle of your garden. It's all these forces in the society that are, you've got to deal with all of them. So don't just think of your little garden as some kind of an entity. It's a part of a much bigger thing. As for human manure, it kind of ties in with the same thing. We don't use animal manure because since we're not keeping animals, where would we get the manure? We'd have to bring it from somewhere else, and we're trying to avoid a system that brings stuff in from outside. But as long as we're here and as long as we're eating, we're going to have our manure. And we live out in the country where we have a privy. We don't have a septic field or a municipal sewage system. Otherwise, it would be a very different story. But since we are generating this stuff anyway, it occurred to us this stuff is really, really precious. This is far from being a waste product. Human beings eat better than probably any other species on Earth. We eat richer, more richer stuff, and it's got to reflect in our waste. And so even though our manure, our own feces, could never be enough to drive the system, in terms of building our soil system, it's fairly insignificant. It is, if you'll pardon the expression, a drop in the bucket, or not even a drop in the bucket. So on the one hand, it's not enough to drive things. We're really counting on the hay and the leaves and all that stuff. But on the other hand, it is far too valuable that 4 to 6 or 8 wheelbarrowfuls a year of finished composted human manure is far too valuable to waste. So I'm very glad.
Okay, Will, we're out of time.
There we go. That was fun.
It was fun, and all of this is so fascinating, and we have so much more to talk about. I really am sincere. I want to hear when your next book is out, and we can talk more about that. Thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food, Will, and I invite everyone to check out your Essential Guide to Radical Self-Reliant Gardening and Gardens Without Borders. Thank you. Well, we're at the end. I'm Karen Hartglass, and you've been listening to It's All About Food. Find me at responsibleeatingandliving.com. Write me at info@realmeals.org, and have a delicious week. Bye-bye.